This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
All righty, welcome to episode 29 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes, and this week we have the new voice of the Detroit Tigers, Jason Benetti, joining us. Jason, thanks so much for taking some time to come on the podcast today. We are not even 1 month removed from you being named the voice of the Tigers. Has the new title set in yet?
Yeah, it's funny. Every time people say it, it sinks in more. I have had this feeling for the last month of, I really wish it were March. I just want to go play games. Like, I want to go to spring training. I want to go live it, because I do know once I'm in it. And every time I've been to Detroit, it has really, they have made me feel so much at home that I want to get this thing going.
So when you joined the White Sox broadcast back in 2016, it was thought of as your dream job. You grew up in Chicago. You were a White Sox fan. You're getting to follow in the footsteps of Hawk Harrelson. I think anybody in that situation is going to categorize it as a dream job. So looking back on the last 7 seasons, was it a dream job?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was awesome. Everything about doing the games and the partnership with Stoney and everybody in the truck, like, some of the most difficult phone calls I had to make were our production team, because I do think we had some of the most creative people on the planet working on that show. And so, yeah, it was awesome. I mean, I love the city of Chicago. I grew up loving the team. We had some awesome times. And yeah, it's funny. When I got the job, one of the first things I thought of as I was talking to people about it was Doug Marrone, which is a funny person to think of in this scenario. But when I lived in Syracuse after I graduated, I was doing some pre and post game TV stuff for then Time Warner. And Doug Marrone he had just left as the Syracuse football coach, and Scott Schaefer took over for him. And Doug Marrone, in his introductory press conference, said it was his dream job to be the head coach of the Syracuse Orange. And then he left. And I was like, man, that's got to be really tough. And, you know, I heard what everybody said about it. And so I totally get where everybody's coming from when you leave something that feels like your dream job. But I also watched it happen, and I do get it from Doug's perspective and, you know, personally from mine.
Did you still consider yourself a White Sox fan when you joined that broadcast crew in 2016? Like, I know a lot of broadcasters and media people, by the time they get to those jobs, they say that they can't maintain rooting interests. Others, such as in New York, Howie Rose and Gary Cohen, they don't hide the fact that they are still diehard fans. So how did you approach that?
Well, who's your favorite team, Brandon?
The Mets.
Like, if somebody said to you, is it possible for you to take your history with the Mets out of your heart? What would you say?
No, of course not.
Yeah. So I don't say that to be glib. I say that because, like, humanity is real. You know, where you grew up is real. That always has a place in your heart. But it is also funny how we can. So the answer is yes. I couldn't help but still be a fan. But some of my best friends in the world and the people that are closest to my heart are from Syracuse or Winston-Salem, North Carolina, or wherever I've been down the road. And so to me, like, yeah, there's history where you grew up, and that will always exist. And it did. It definitely did. And you're not going to take the Chicago out of me. But you're also not going to take the Syracuse out of me, and you're not going to take the High Point, North Carolina out of me, and all that stuff. So it's, yeah, where you grew up matters in a big way and always will.
Does being a fan of the team that you're calling games for make it easier or harder to call those games? Like, obviously you it probably helps that you have a history with the team, and you know the team in and out. But at the same time, Do you try to, when you're on the broadcast, do you try to not let the fact that you are a fan bleed into the broadcast?
Yeah, you know, like, I like to think that what I do and how I approach calling games is like a pretty real way. Like I listen to my heart quite a bit, just in terms of the moment and the energy of the moment. And I listen to the fans in the background and my partner next to me. So I'm not really calculating that per se.
Sure.
I'm more living it than anything. So I think it's much more about like the style of how I call a game. And I really do cherish the opportunity to, and I sound like a press release when I say it that way, but it really is important to me to hit the moment right, to have the right energy for the moment. And so, yeah, I think it has to bleed through, but it's kind of the funny part about me taking the Tigers job is I've watched a lot of Tigers games simply because the White Sox played the Tigers a lot, not only when I was doing the job, but like Cecil Fielder, Tiger Stadium, that whole thing, that's real too. And so I happen to have a history. If you said to me, hey, we're going to create a league and you need to go do that league right now from square one, I would have to build up the rivalries and the emotions and the care and that. And I think you kind of do that by getting to know the fans and the people who are really invested in it. Like, I don't like seeing my friends lose more than, you know, like seeing a team lose. So when there are people I like whose jobs are at stake, when there are people I know whose jobs are at stake, and to be honest, when I'm doing a national game and I know the story of the players, like Michael Penix Jr. a couple weeks ago in the Apple Cup had been through all these injuries, and he shows up at Washington and he's trying to make a team be undefeated. And you watch him not be able to look at that game-winning field goal. When you have a sense of the stakes of the person in that moment, I think that's where the energy comes from more than maybe the jersey even.
So, I mean, nobody leaves their dream job for just any job. So what made Detroit seem like it was the right fit to be that next step for your career?
Well, I almost ended up working day to day with AJ Hinch a couple years ago when he almost got hired as the manager of the White Sox. Part of it is the front office of the Tigers and the direction they're going and how they've started to develop young talent and they're willing to spend on free agents and that combination. But I will also say, like, as part of the process, everybody at Bally Detroit and everybody with the Tigers said, we want to have the best broadcast in the country. And that's appealing to me because that is, in part, it sounds a lot like an opportunity to really just get after it creatively. And that is the part of this I love. Like, it's why I love Brock Huard as a football partner, because he is so curious and he's such a good teammate. He is like the best galvanizing force I have ever been around on a team. And he leads to creative stuff because he does the work. And for me, that's a lot like what I heard from the Tigers, is we're a group, we're a team, we want you for you, and we want to go get after it.
How was your relationship with the White Sox front office and ownership?
Yeah, you know, like I had a lot of great experiences with the White Sox. You know, creatively, I think you could argue that they wanted something of a more traditional broadcast than is my general, you know, I like doing games with Bill Walton sort of sensibility, right? Like, I want to be the person who has the range to do all of it, right? Who can have a good time when you need to have a good time, but nail the big moment when you need to nail the big moment. And I'm really proud of the work we've done in that department on the Sox telecast. But, you know, I do believe creatively there will be more of an opportunity to just, you know, it's not a comedy show, right? But I do think one of the pillars of what we do is that whole tenet, yes, and, right? From improv comedy, like you just go with wherever the situation takes you. And I think the Tigers really just want that on their show. Like wherever you and your partner or partners go, that's where we want you to go.
Did you get complaints from Reinsdorf at all? Like, I know Dan Bernstein came out and he was pretty strong in saying that Jerry Reinsdorf did not like your broadcasting style? Like, did you feel that when you were working for the White Sox?
You know, it's you ever watch The Voice?
Yeah.
You know, The Voice, that show on NBC. I love The Voice because you can on stage, you can just be like, you can watch somebody and they just nail it. And three of the four people turn around and you're like, what are you doing? What's the fourth person doing? But that's the fun part of this is like taste. So, you know, like specific complaints, you know, does everybody at the White Sox think I'm fun or funny? Nah, I don't think so. But like, you know, that is why. And Stoney said this all the time when we were working together. Not only are you pitching for your team, but you're pitching for 29 other teams. And so to me, the value is in finding the people who really want you for you instead of the people who like what you do for the fans.
Is Jerry Reinsdorf the same owner with the White Sox that he is with the Bulls? And I guess what I mean by that, because like in New York, it almost feels like the Knicks and Rangers have different owners, even though James Dolan owns both of them. So as somebody that has worked for both the White Sox and the Bulls, is Reinsdorf more hands-on with one than the other?
Honestly, like it's just, I don't really deal with people on that level a ton. I really don't. I had good experiences with people on both sides. I will say, like, the Bulls, even though I did like 10 games a year filling in for Adam, they were unbelievably welcoming and fun and great and everything. And Stacy is an awesome partner. Yeah. So like, I don't really, like, that's almost hearsay to me because I don't know what it's like on that level for both teams. I just know as an announcer, my experience, and you know, generally it was a great experience. But yes, like here's what I will say about all of that, being totally honest. Not everybody's gonna like your personality. And if that's the person that you're working for, if that is true, no matter where you are, and I'm not even talking about my situation, but like my whole deal, Brandon, has always been like, I can't look at a camera directly. I walk differently than other people. So I need to figure out how to make the work as good as possible. So everything we know about first impressions is wrong. And part of that for me is being able to run the gamut of big moment to kind of funny or dorky dad joke, whatever it was. And what I will say is, I do think the Tigers are a place that really, really appreciates that. And everybody can read between the lines beyond that.
Yeah. So there's broadcaster changes on the TV and radio side in baseball every offseason. Were you surprised by the amount of press and attention that yours got?
It felt for a second like it was MLB trade rumors. Like then the end run is like, my whole deal when I was growing up is I wanted to be the radio voice of a college team because it seemed like there were a lot of those. And I just wanted to describe the heck out of games. Like I grew up in radio and I love that. And then to have entire cities be interested in what was happening with me. And I don't say this out of like false, oh shucks ishness. Like, I never really wanted this or dreamed of it. I just like doing games because it feels like a crossword puzzle to me. And then suddenly you end up in a situation where it's like, whoa, we took Benetti from you. And it's like, you took who from where from what? Like, I literally just do the games. And so that's why all of this, to be totally frank with you, has been hard for me. Because I know White Sox fans invested a ton in our show. And we kind of asked them to, right? Like we play parlor games, we play Sox Math, we have people send in videos, we play Is It Raining? And they tell us if it's raining in their neighborhood. Like, I want to play games with people at home because I enjoy playing games. Sports is supposed to be connective. I love that stuff. Like, that is the point of a Major League Baseball telecast. So to leave all of those people who have invested, and I still have a bunch of DMs on Twitter that I just haven't had the heart to respond to yet, because like, I can rattle off for you all of our Sox Math winners and like the videos they sent in. Like, Mike Ganella is a cinematic genius, and he's a guy at home who's a big Sox fan, but he churned out constantly like Sorkin-esque videos on our telecast. And this guy, Caden Strenz, kept winning Sox Math last year to the point where it's like, we've run out of prizes, dude. Like, he was basically the Ken Jennings of Sox Math last year. And there are all these people who've invested so much, and it was really, really difficult to do, like more difficult than I expected, in part because of the fact that everybody cares so much about their baseball team.
When you got into broadcasting baseball, like, did you strive to have that connection? Cause like, I think for me as a Mets fan, when Gary Cohen or Howie Rose retires, I will be upset. But if one of them left for another team, I would probably be devastated. And that's with me recognizing like the ins and outs of the business. But for me, at least, I think that feeling is exclusive to baseball. So like, is that something that is that, first of all, is that what makes baseball so special, that unique connection to fans? And is that something that you strived to have, or did you just kind of find that you were able to build that connection once you got into the job?
Yeah, that's a really good and deep question. And I honestly think it started in the minors. Like, first of all, you have the best in the business with the Mets, so I would be devastated if they left too. Like, Gary and Howie and Keith and Ronnie are like, they're awesome.
Yeah,
they're just
tremendous.
Phenomenal. Like that booth, like you were asking about like creative stuff with the White Sox and all that. Like, this is a small thing, but like by the end of the year last year, I was not allowed to eat on camera because evidently it's grotesque when I eat on camera. So I show up, I'm like a jackal when I'm eating, and some people had a problem with it, even though I was trying to sell the ballpark food, right? So I go to do a Mets game. I go to do a Mets game at Citi Field for Fox, and I'm watching doubleheader game one in my hotel room in Manhattan. And no joke, Keith or Ronnie, one of the two, was like, you know what would taste good right now? Shake Shack. And here comes an intern within like 5 minutes with a whole tray of Shake Shack, and they go to town. And I was like, they get to eat. That's ridiculous. But that's the kind, they have so much freedom. I'm glad you brought them up, because like, they have so much freedom to do whatever comes into their mind. And the telecast shows it. Like, they just go. Like, they went in the blowout when they read the media guide is one of my favorite things in history, because it's so organic and it's so them and it's so real. But like, I do think, to answer your question, this all started in the minors for me. I did 4 years of AAA baseball with Baltimore Orioles announcer Kevin Brown, who you may have featured on this here website at some point over the course of this past season.
Yes,
he is a creative genius. I love him dearly. He is one of my best friends in the world. And we used to just kind of, you know, in AAA, not only is there no real holy grail, there is a championship, but nobody wants to be there for it because they want to be in the majors to win the World Series. So, and we had bad AAA teams. Like, if you combine the records of the 4 years that we were there, it's real bad. And so we just had to find ways to creatively push each other. And I think by doing that, we saw that fans jumped on that stuff as well. Like, our first year together, Kevin was right out of college, and we used to play a game called You Been There, No. And so it would be like, okay, here comes, Joe Smith from Santa Rosa, California. Kev, you been there? Nope. Okay. And he's got a 4.26 ERA. And the whole bit was just me asking if he's been there and him saying no, because he had never been anywhere. He was 21 at the time. And every once in a while, we'd have a plot twist and it would be, you been there? Yes. And it would turn into an amazing bit of radio, or so we thought. But that's the whole premise behind baseball every day is, yeah, the game carries it sometimes, but then other times you just have to use your brain to see where it's going to flow.
So you mentioned the freedom that Gary, Keith, and Ron enjoy. You also obviously just brought up Kevin Brown as well. So I'll ask, did what happened to Kevin Brown with the Orioles over the summer at all play a role into your decision of parting ways with the White Sox? Like, did what happened remind you of the importance of having the freedom to kind of say what you want, or more so say what you think needs to be said on a broadcast?
No, you know, honestly, like criticism wise, that was never an issue with the White Sox. And I give them a great deal of credit for that. Like, we were able to be honest about the situation. And Stoney, I think, is fairly critical, not like marginally critical, but when he's critical, he's very fair about it. And he is somebody who praises people when they deserve it as well. So that was never a thing for me. The reason the Kevin Brown thing resonated with me is I love the guy.
Yeah.
Like, he is one of my best friends, and he is one of the nicest people in America. And he never looks for hot take points. He never looks to snipe at people. He is way kinder than I ever am. I mean, he really is truly one of the most marvelous people I've ever gotten a chance to meet and do games with. And so I was just pissed off because he doesn't deserve any of that. And like, he'll be mad that I'm talking about this again because he just wants to go live his life with his newborn daughter and his wife. Like, he just wants to go be a human being. And this all became very all encompassing. But I will say, it was pretty awesome to watch. Or like, I will always appreciate Orioles fans to the end of the earth for chanting his name in the stadium that night. That, like, yeah, I cried that night.
Maybe it's hard to answer this because it's, I don't want to ask you to put yourself in his shoes or say what Kevin should do or anything like that. But if you were in a situation where you felt like you couldn't be critical or say what needed to be said, do you think you would have trouble working for that team?
Yeah. I mean, but the other thing people need to realize, and I think why Gary and I and it's hard to list everybody who took a shot at the Orioles that night, as you may recall from, again, this here website, like you all did this whole compendium of everything that everyone said. And I was really proud to be a play-by-play announcer that night, because that's why it was so important we all stood up for each other that night, because there are only 30 of these. Like, it's great for me to be able to say, like, oh, I want to go somewhere where they let me say stuff. And again, that was not a thing with the White Sox. Like, ours was, hey, don't eat on camera, like, don't be so funny sort of thing, right? The stuff that really fires my brain specifically. So it's really small potatoes compared to being able to be critical. The answer would be yes for me with my journalism background, but I also will say, it is very, very, very difficult to get these jobs. And I will say, too, it requires people to take a chance on you. You know, and this is why, like, no matter what happened with the White Sox, and I know I was being a little dodgy earlier, and here's the reason why, honestly. Even though I left, and there have been all these discussions about my sense of humor, which is not a perfect 10 anyway, and, you know, things people have said and all of that, they still hired me in 2016 when I wasn't a major league announcer. And I'm not saying I'm bowing to the feet of somebody who hired me, but they took a chance, man. Like, they really took a chance on somebody who was not yet a major league announcer. And I have no choice but to appreciate it deep in my heart. And I do, because to hire somebody with CP who has not done major league games to be your announcer takes guts. And no matter where the relationship ended up, and I do have a lot of fond memories, and all the stuff we're talking about really is small potatoes and pales in comparison to why I really left to take the Tigers job. And it's because of the Tigers and because of what they wanted out of me and what they saw in me. There are 30 of these, man. Like, it's way harder to become a major league play-by-play announcer probabilistically than a major league player. That is ridiculous, but it's true. And it's not something I take lightly.
When you first took a conversation with the Tigers, did it feel at that point like you were probably going to leave the White Sox, or did you more so expect to like have that conversation and say, no, you know, I'm going to stay here in Chicago?
You know, right away, a lot of the questions the Tigers asked me was about what I do, how I do it, what I hold dear, what matters to me, and what matters to me in a crew and in an analyst. And a lot of their questions were about creating a team. And that's what I've always loved about this whole thing. Like our whole TV crew for college football went to U2 in Vegas after the Mountain West title game. We got all 10 people on our traveling crew, other than our stat guy who had to leave. But like all 10 people went to the concert together. We had a great time. That's the reason to do television in so many ways. And so, the part of what the Tigers asked me right off the top was about how to create a team and where I fit in that team and what I cherish in a broadcast and all of that stuff. So like, I didn't know if it was going to be the right fit, and they didn't know. And, you know, some people I think in my position would have been like, what, like, why do we have to do 7 hours of interviews? You know me, I know you. But I'd rather we get together and figure each other out and make sure it's the right fit. And then once I got into that, it felt a lot like my move from ESPN to Fox. Like ESPN took a chance on me. I started on lower level games, grew within that in ESPN. And then it turned out that there was a little bit of a ceiling in terms of what the assignments might be in the end. I moved to Fox in part because I was a free agent and they came and got me. And the White Sox did the same for me. And then the Tigers said, hey, we've watched you, we like you, let's do this. And it's just a different relationship when it starts at that point. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. How was the challenge of replacing Hawk Harrelson, just somebody that who had been there for so long and was as popular and tied into the fan base as he was?
Yeah, it's a really interesting deal to be the guy after that guy, especially when you grew up watching him. Like, I part of the reason I'm doing this job is because I loved watching Hawk and Wimpy together. And so, you know, early on, and I've said this before, so it's a little bit of retread, but Hawk was great to me. Like, he basically said, you be you, I'll be me, and we'll go from there. And he's always been great to me. Like when I got COVID in 2021, he was texting me, called me and asked me if he could like send me some bourbon, which is awesome and like the most Hawk thing ever. So I love the guy, and I am not him at all. And he is not me, and we are each other, and you know, all of that. We're separate people. But I do think it's really cool that a fan base could embrace both of us, because it shows kind of the range of White Sox fans too.
Did you speak to him at all about the decision to leave?
I didn't. First of all, I think, you know, I didn't speak to many people about it at all, because I, you know, it's a pretty delicate matter when you're leaving one team for another team.
Sure.
But you know, I that was something that I kept pretty close to the vest.
What did you think in October of 2020 when the White Sox hired Tony La Russa? What did you think of that hire at the time?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my feeling was, again, I think I said this already, like I thought AJ Hinch was going to be the guy.
Yeah.
And I, you know, when I was at ESPN, I think, you know, that, you know, part of what was the coolest portion of my ESPN tenure was doing the StatCast games. And so I learned a lot about like the value of a home run in winning a major league game and the difficulty in justifying bunts in terms of probability with what we know now. I read right. Moneyball. I liked Moneyball, but I also have an appreciation for the history of the game. And so I'm not going to say like it was a no for me, but I also do think that the game has changed
yeah.
over the course of time. And look, everybody's heard the clip of the 1-2 intentional walks, plural.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say about that. I don't, but he's also a Hall of Famer. And so, you know, you give people the benefit of the doubt. I would be a total hypocrite if I said, like, you hire somebody and I say, that's not going to work, because that's what I don't want people to do to me. But I also thought AJ Hinch was going to be a really good manager.
Were you on the broadcast the day that it appeared that he fell asleep in the dugout?
I was not.
You were not.
I was off. Yeah.
Yeah. I was. Is that something that because I know Steve Stone, I think, came out after and kind of almost like faulted the broadcast for even showing that. But like, I don't know, the way it happened, it didn't seem like it was intentional. Like they had a shot on him and then he just kind of started long blinking as more so than even, it's not like he was sleeping and then the cameras went on him. Did you think that was something, like seeing the clip as all of us did you think that's something that was egregious by the network at all?
I love our crew. Even if I thought it was egregious, which I didn't, I wouldn't say anything against our crew because I love them dearly and I think they are marvelous. And, you know, but I didn't think it was egregious because, you know, stuff that happens in front of the cameras happens in front of the cameras, and that's whatever it is. But I also think it was totally overblown. Yep. Like I think like everybody in every major league dugout has a moment that they would want back or whatever it might be. And he, that I don't even know what that was, to be totally honest. Like, again, if anybody's like, whoa, you don't work for the White Sox, don't be a shill anymore. I really thought that was overblown. And I'm telling you right now, I wouldn't walk anybody intentionally on a ball in two strikes. So like that's how I feel about that situation.
Are you a broadcaster who likes to be in the clubhouse, like present and make yourself available to the players and manager and coaches?
I think you have to. I learned it from a guy that I worked with in AAA, Bob McElligott, who's now the radio voice of the Columbus Blue Jackets. He was down there every day and getting to know players and getting to know why they're doing things. And I just graduated college. I'm sitting upstairs with my PowerPoint slides on every player. Like, could you be nerdier? Right, that's how I did my prep at the time. And then he'd come up and he'd be like, hey, did you know Colin Ballester's dad ran a surf shop? And I'm like, where'd you hear that? And he's like, from him. I was just talking to him, you clown. Basically, you know, he didn't say that. Bob is great. He wouldn't say that to me. But like, I learned very early on that that's where you get the best, most novel stuff that can really spice up a broadcast. And I do think, again, I know people are on the hunt for like, why did he leave the White Sox? I feel like in part, we are going to have some changes that just come from the strife that 2020 and 2021 brought all of us in the booth. Like in those 2 years, we just weren't allowed to be around the players. And by changes, I just mean like broadcasters having conflict with other people in the organization because we couldn't travel and maybe somebody goes to one place or another after that. I do think that's part of this is like, we couldn't do our jobs for real for 2 years. 2020 was completely justified. I was very outspoken in 2021 about the value of being around players and telling those stories and really fleshing out the people. And we couldn't do that. So all we had was each other, you know, and I think Stoney and I had a great deal of fun and told some great stories, but it wasn't going to come from the clubhouse. And I think over the course of time, you would feel the difference in that. So yes, it is everything to me. On the rare day where I don't get down there because of some obligation, I don't feel like I can do the job nearly as well.
Do you know who your analyst or who your analysts are going to be with the Tigers?
Yeah, I don't think it's set in stone. I mean, the two people I've spoken to already are Craig Monroe and Kirk Gibson. And I know both of them, and I'm excited to have both of them. I don't know the full range of who it's going to be, but I know they're going to be involved. And that's the fun part for me. Like, you know, I'm sure you watched some of the Peacock games. That was like Wonka's factory for me, right? Like, I get two new people every week just to see where it goes and see if you isolate this variable, what it sounds like differently. So I'm really excited to to build those relationships and enjoy the heck out of those people. And then, you know, wherever it goes with the extra games, we'll have a good time too.
Will you have a say, or do you want to have a say in those decisions?
I have a say in enough in my life. Like, I get to pick, like what I ordered at Starbucks, which is awesome. Like, no, part of the thing that I love about the Tigers is they want to do it as a group. So I think they're going to ask my opinion, but I also think I'm going to ask their opinion on a lot of stuff. So like, I know that's not a yes or a no per se, but I do think it's going to be a group function if we're going to make great TV. And no, I hate when people get veto power over stuff that they shouldn't have veto power on. It's silly. So like, no, I don't want that.
How do the Tigers feel about the fact that you do national work as well, in addition to calling the local games?
Well, they put the number of games I'm doing in the press release, so I think they're very happy with it.
Comfortable.
I think they're, yeah. I mean, that, look, that's the other part of all of this is like, when I showed up with the White Sox, I wasn't missing games at first. And then as it went along, that got to be more and more. And so like, there's more possible strain, right? And so with the Tigers, we just hammered it out in the deal and we agreed to it. So like, for me and for them, it's just, it's done. Like, it's part of what's going to happen.
Right.
And that's kind of it.
Do you think local baseball is always going to be a part of your repertoire? Like, because I think it's interesting when Joe Buck gets asked about missing, whether or not he misses calling baseball games, he always says specifically that he misses doing local baseball. Like, he misses being part of a team and the feeling that feeling of a connection to a city like he had in St. Louis. So do you think this is something that even as your national platform grows, that you're always going to want to have that local connection?
Yeah. I mean, yes, it's, I easily could have just not done baseball right now. Like, Fox is treating me well. They've been amazing. Like, I get to work with very fun people at all times at Fox. And so I could have made that decision now, but I truly found a team that really wants to do this in a way that's high level. And that's a thing that my heart just cannot say no to. And so, yes, I think the answer is I will always want to do that. Will the stars align that the organization and I have an opening at the same time like this? I don't know.
Sure.
But yeah, I love doing it. I love being a part of a team, and nobody's hiring me right now to be in their Hollywood writer's room. So I'm going to do baseball. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I love most about calling baseball, is that you feel you're putting on a show every day that has to be this amazing collaborative effort, and it has to be different than yesterday, or else the characters are going to get stale. I mean, imagine if in one season of Breaking Bad, there were 162 episodes. It would be like Jesse goes to Publix. This is horrible. It would be like the Fly episode would happen 12 times over the course of a season. Nobody wants that. So, and we don't have a writers. We just have each other. So that's what excites me about it most.
You're very open about having cerebral palsy. What does it mean to you that you were able to overcome that to not only get to your dream job of being a broadcaster, but like you initially mentioned, you thought about doing it on the radio, but now the fact that you are also regularly on camera on national television as well?
Yeah, it means the world to me, and I hope it means something to anybody who's different. I hope it means that people who get poked fun at as a kid for whatever they have, right? I hope that gives them the opportunity to say, screw it. I'm going to go perform anyway. I'm going to go be in front of a camera. I'm going to go dance for a living. I'm going to go do stand up. I'm going to go do whatever it is, because it doesn't matter what I look like. And so, yeah, it means a great deal. And, you know, to everybody who's been part of my career, It's a huge thank you. But then beyond that, you know, I've always had the fear that somebody might give me a job just because they like the story or because they think it would win them points or they feel sorry for me. Like, you know, I've mentioned once or twice in speaking engagements, but like I became the sports director at WAER, the radio station in Syracuse, the college radio station. I became the person in charge as a student, as one senior is every year. And then somebody put up on their away message on AOL Instant Messenger, gosh, we're old. His away message, because he wasn't happy that I gave him some assignment, was at least he'll be a great story in somebody's magazine one day. And so like when you have a history of those things, yeah, I know people probably get tired of hearing me talk about my disability, but it's part of me. And it has created, you know, substantial emotional swings. But to not just be a great story for somebody's magazine and to have reached the point of the caliber that two places, one national and one team, would say, no, 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 we want you, in like the old Uncle Sam poster sort of way, that that means the world to me. And it means that there's hope for people who are different, I guess.
Were you self-conscious about being on camera earlier in your career?
Oh, yeah. There are old college roommates and friends of mine that could tell you that, like, to do a 30-second on camera around a package in one of our newscast classes, it would take me like 45 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Because I was so mad at myself for my hands or the way I said it, or I was nervous and I was going too fast or I was going too slow, or I didn't like this one, or let's do it again. And it's just like, dude, shut up. I don't know how they put up with it, but yeah, like it was, I'm glad we didn't do it on cell phones because those things would exist still. They're on like old DVC pro tapes that nobody will ever find. And it was, yeah. I had no interest in doing TV. Like there are a bunch of TV stations for students at Syracuse and TV opportunities. And there was no chance I was doing that. None.
You mentioned you went to Syracuse, one of the sportscaster breeding grounds. But then you also went to law school at Wake Forest. Was the goal still to be a broadcaster while you were in law school?
Yeah. I did games while I was in law school. So I was working at a small school in North Carolina, High Point University. I was doing their men's basketball games. And then I was also working for a rights holder that's now Learfield, ISP Sports. So I was a studio host for like Georgia Tech, Florida State, Notre Dame, just like doing sports score updates in the middle of their broadcasts, their radio broadcasts. And so, yeah, I went to law school for the education of it. And I, you know, I didn't really want to become an attorney, but I did want the education and I do use it. Like I, you know, one of the things I learned is like when, and I'm saying this because you are so good at asking short questions and I respect the hell out of that because it keeps the other person on their toes. And I appreciate it because when people insert themselves into questions, they poison the river of the answer. And you haven't done that once, which is actually remarkable. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now get out of the way so I can answer. No, the like when you're cross-examining a witness and it's not your witness, it's the opposing witness. You say things like, so you were at this address yesterday, right? And they have to say yes or no. But when it's your witness, you say things like, where were you yesterday? So they get the chance to really tell their story. And so that difference has played a major role in like production meetings for me, talking to players, letting people tell their stories rather than guiding them to something because I want a soundbite.
Interestingly, another broadcaster who went to law school is Bill Walton. So who do you think would make the better attorney, you or Bill?
Can you? That is probably the best question I've ever heard in my life. I'm just picturing a sitcom where we are two attorneys at the same firm and like there, you know, some clients get filtered to me because they're the straight-laced ones, and then other clients get filtered to Bill because they taste colors. And I just like the idea of the odd couple sort of scenario there. I think his mind is like nitroglycerin. Like, being around him is the most explosive time you can have in your life, cerebrally. And so thinking about him as an attorney, I don't know what the jurors would think. Like, I'm picturing the jury box. I'm picturing me being the opposition and listening to him and looking and being like, I actually don't know what the hell they think about that. I have no clue. And so I think the answer is him, because he's a highly creative person. But I would love to be in a case against him, because he, like, the sneaky thing about Bill is he's uber competitive. And I would really enjoy the idea of sparring with him, like a forensics tournament with Bill Walton, a debate tournament with Bill Walton could be amazing television. Like, Bill, take this side, right? Like, fracking is a good idea. Go. I would love that.
How was working with Bill overall? I assume that's not something that you had on your bingo card back when you were in college.
Dude, it's the best. I mean, it is such an enlivening experience, because I have to be ready for literally everything. I've always thought play-by-play is a test in that moment of everything you know. But we're not going to hit the range with anybody else that Bill hits. So I have to be ready for him to ask me, like, have you read Steve Martin's book? What do you think of Myanmar? Like, that's the range. That's the spectrum. And it really is like doing a crossword puzzle, except nobody tells you how many letters are in the word. And frankly, there are no clues. You just have to go and say words and see if you can follow along.
Is there one thing that he said to you on a broadcast that either surprised you or made you laugh, caught you off guard more than the rest that sticks out?
I mean, there are so many. The time that he asked if my father ever played for Jerry Tarkanian, and I said, no, my dad was an air traffic controller. And then he was like, but did he play for Jerry Tarkanian? I mean, you just keep going. When he did the White Sox game with me, and the first question he asked James McCann in our post-game interview, he had a bunch of eye black on, and Bill said, what is that under your eyes? That was the first question. It's like doing a game with the mind of an 8-year-old in the best way. You know how kids will just, like, say the thing that they see to their discredit sometimes? Like, that's what he does. And then he asked halfway through the interview, James was about to leave, and I said, okay, James, great job. And he said something like, Bill, do you have any other questions? And I said, the rest of this is on you, okay? Because you had the chance to leave and you didn't. And then, but James loved it. He really enjoyed the whole experience. And then Bill asked him, like, what do you eat before a game? This is a post-game interview. It's supposed to be like three questions. It just kept going and going and going. But I truly think the most ridiculous thing we have done together actually involves a tiger. Early 2020, before the pandemic hit, Bill and I had an Arizona State basketball game, and his producer for a lot of games, Tim Sullivan, who is just awesome, Sully had the idea that we would go to Arizona State baseball, and Spencer Torkelson was playing for the Sun Devils at the time, and he was going to be the first overall pick, and he had this idea, Sully did, that Tork would teach Bill Walton how to hit. So we did a whole bit where Bill is in catcher's gear, and he's like starting to play catcher. And then Bill, wearing the catcher's gear, goes into the batting cage wearing full catcher's gear. And Tork is trying to teach him how to hit. And it was an absolute just gushing nightmare geyser of fun. And Tork still remembers it. Like, I went into the Tigers clubhouse in June this year. And Spencer came up to me and was like, how's Bill? I said, you remember that? And he's like, of course I remember that. So, you know, that it's, but it is the spectrum that you cover with Bill Walton. If you like creativity, I suggest it.
Did you have total trust in Bill's filter that whatever he was going to say or wherever he was taking a story, it was going to be fit for a national audience?
Who cares is my answer. That's the fun part. It, you know, fit for a national audience is such a movable standard, and fit for his moral compass is what I knew it would be.
Yeah.
And I also know that, you know, I have my own personal parachute there as well. Like, I don't have to play along per se. If he says something that I don't agree with, I do want to be a good partner, but like, that's the fun of it. The fun of it is you don't know, and you're not certain exactly where it's going to end up, and you react. I mean, my body has never let me be a quarterback, but the idea of like, okay, you're going to have 3 seconds max to throw this pass unless you're really good and evasive. Like, you better know your reads real fast, and you better make that choice. That's fun to watch with like Peyton Manning. It's fun to watch with all these quarterbacks who do it at a high level with Patrick Mahomes. It's fun to do, and that's my only way of doing it in life.
Jason, you were awesome. Thank you so much for joining the podcast today. I really appreciate it.
I'm glad to. Thank you, Brandon.
That is Jason Benetti. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Please rate and subscribe to this podcast. Please also subscribe to Awful Announcing's YouTube page. But regardless of how you consume Awful Announcing and the Awful Announcing Podcast, thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com and follow us at awfulannouncing.com.